Hello and welcome to Ed Talks. My name is Ben Anderson. I left school in 2006 and I'm now a podcast producer. My company is called Sound Rebel. We produce podcasts for businesses, brands, personalities, all sorts of different people all across the world. In this series, I talk to old Edwardians from both the boys and the girls' school about their time at school, but also about their careers, because we are very lucky to say that the alumni of King Edward School have gone off to do lots of weird and wonderful things for the rest of their lives after crossing Edgbaston Park Road for the very last time. Today, I am joined by Robert Worley. Robert's left school in 1965 and went to study at Cambridge, and has spent 36 years working for the UK government as a civil servant. And at this point, Robert, I'd like to pass over to you. First of all, thank you ever so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Ben. It's very good to be here. I'm pleased to join you. I'm very pleased to contribute to this excellent series, and well done for laying it on.
Your career has taken you to, well, you've held a number of different incredibly high profile roles within the government. And rather than me giving a brief history, I'd like to pass over to you.
And yes, I did indeed work for the British government as a civil servant for over 36 years. And I had a wonderful career doing many different things. When you join the civil service, you never know quite what's going to happen to you. And I had a small letter saying I was being posted to the Home Office, and I was to turn up on a certain day, which I did, not knowing quite what was going to happen. And I suppose that I did so many different things over those 36 years, it's hard to put really the most important, but I guess I spent some time in Northern Ireland because the crisis in Northern Ireland was running very soon then, and the Home Office in those days ran Northern Ireland policy. I can tell you about that. I also had 7 years as Director of Immigration Policy for the UK, and that took me all over the world into some extraordinary situations and met a whole range of people. And then for the last 5 years, I was Director, as you say, for Counterterrorism and Intelligence at the Home Office. And that took us all the way through 9/11 and the years after that. And I had a role in the Cabinet Office too, sharing out the senior work there. So I had some extraordinary things, and I was very privileged to be able to contribute to all of those. And many times I felt myself saying in my career, you know, I learned how to handle this when I was at KES. And that's one of the nice things, one of the nice reasons for joining in these programmes.
Robert, I'd like to start back in Birmingham, if that's okay. We'll obviously talk about Northern Ireland and everywhere else that you visited as part of your immigration role. But you left school in 1965, which meant you were a teenager in the late 50s, early 60s. What was Birmingham like as a city in that period?
Well, it was a great place then, just as it's a great place now. I think you really felt you were in the iron heart of England, because industry and heavy industry was what mattered then. And I lived in the latter years not far away from the Austin Car Works at Longbridge. And I remember all the drums, the heavy beat of the hammers and the presses going, making out all those motor cars. And of course, when the wind blew in from the southwest in King Edwards, you got the smell from the chocolate factory at Cadbury's. So you had all those things going through as well. But I thought it was a great city. And I used to wander around the city thinking, you know, this is a city of 1,000 trades. This is where Joseph Chamberlain ran his empire. And I used to go to concerts in the town hall long before Symphony Hall. And I had the great advantage of going to the university across the road, the bookshop there, the students' union there. We had the Shakespeare Institute just along the road. It's now moved to Stratford, but it was just along the road for someone like me doing English. That was a great place to browse around. So I felt very privileged, not only to be there, but for the great range of opportunities I had. It was a great city, and it still is.
And speaking of opportunities, obviously, you know, King Edwards gave us all many opportunities. How was it like for you in terms of turning up as an 11-year-old boy at King Edwards School? Did you find it intimidating?
I didn't find it intimidating. And I had been to primary schools in King's Heath and in Northfield and then out at Rendall when we moved out there. I had a little bit of a head start because my father was on the staff at King Edward School. He was the senior geography master for 27 years. My elder brother was already at the school. In fact, the school was very much in my bloodstream long before I went there. Our social group, to use that phrase, were other common room staff and their families, and we used to meet regularly. So I knew everybody. I knew a lot about the school long before I got there. Of course, you still had to take the exam. Being a master's son did not give you a free pass. That would not have been fair to anybody. So I took the exam, and in fact, I nearly didn't get in because my maths was not very good at all. And I had to go back to do a second set of tests and interviews to make sure I was reasonably numerate to go to the place. So when I got there, I realized I did have to work hard. There were a lot of very clever boys there, and I had to make sure I could keep up. So I suppose from then on, I was quite driven about things. I worked incredibly hard, and I wanted to make sure I did what I was expected to do. And I was always conscious that it was a great privilege to be there, and I was very lucky to be there. In those days, of course, King Edward's was a direct grant grammar school. It was a day where all that mattered was passing the exam. It was a place where it didn't matter how much money your parents had, you had to get in on brains. And in that sense, it was quite a classless school, quite a classless society. We were not conscious at all of anybody's wealth or background, really how you were getting on with what you were supposed to be doing. And I felt it was very sad when the direct grant schools were phased out and the school had to go into a sort of independent mold. And I regretted that because I think it lost the sort of wide range, the eclectic range of people who were going there, the huge range of backgrounds. And it became something where money was more important and, or just as important as brains. And I thought that was sad. So one of the reasons I'm so pleased to support the assisted places scheme is to try to get back to somewhere, the world where money doesn't particularly matter. And I pay great tribute to John Claughton for the 10 years he was there in getting the school back to what it was, in terms of its traditional role as a city grammar school for poor, bright kids. And that is the future of this place.
When you went to Cambridge, did you have the civil service in mind? As you know, this podcast is listened to by old Edwardians across the world, which is great to be able to say, but also current students. Did you go to Cambridge thinking the civil service is what I would like to achieve out of the back of achieving my degree at Cambridge? Or is that something that you weren't aware of at the time?
No, I had no idea about the civil service at all when I went to Cambridge. In those days, a third of the school went on to Oxford or Cambridge. It was a fairly natural progression. And you did so possibly without a great deal of thought about what you were going to do, unless you were a natural scientist or a medic or something. It was the thing that you did when you left school. You went on to university to read an art subject. I had no real idea what I was going to do with it, nor did I really have much idea until after I left Cambridge as to what I wanted to do. But I realized pretty soon that I would like to do something by way of administration. And I suppose being at school and being a senior boy, I'd learned quite a lot about how to make things happen and how to organize things and get around problems and bring people along with you and so on. And I developed that kind of skill while I was at Cambridge. And so when the chance came to take the civil service exams, I thought, okay, I'll have a go and see what happens, not knowing whether I'd get in or not, because I knew it was very competitive. Well, I did get in. In fact, I came the first class of my year for the civil service, and that gave me some encouragement. So then off I went to the Home Office, not knowing quite what I was going to do, and the world started from there, really.
And what was your first role within the Home Office?
The first role in the Home Office was working in the criminal justice policy, dealing with the probation service and the aftercare of prisoners on release, which was, for someone like me, completely new. I never dealt with prisoners before or the systems for looking after prisoners. But that was at a time when, as I said before, the Home Office ran Northern Ireland policy. And things in Northern Ireland were getting very bad. And a number of us young graduates, when the administrative graduate scheme, were pretty soon moved over to work on Northern Ireland policy in the Home Office.
And was this the early 70s?
Yes, that's right. Yes, in 1971. I remember the internment in 1971 and all the riots which followed from that. I remember with great sadness the Bloody Sunday massacres in 1972, when we were all rung up at home and told to come into the office that afternoon. And we all went in there. And then I think I realized after that that there was no going back in Northern Ireland and there would have to be a change of government. And as you may know, the Northern Ireland government was disbanded by Edward Heath and a Rex Rule came in with a Secretary of State, Willie Whitelaw. Well, very soon after that happened, I was sent off to Belfast. I was summoned at Friday afternoon and told to pack my bag and get on a plane to Belfast on Monday morning, which I did. And then I had 15 months in Belfast in a very privileged role running the private office of the Secretary of State, Willie Whitelaw. And here was I, a young 25-year-old, meeting generals, politicians, intelligence chiefs, chief constables, on the phone to number 10 most days, right in the middle of an impending civil war. 572 people were murdered in the year and the bit that I was there. I was out and about at the weekends, going around all the housing estates and looking at all the trouble that was going on. And I suppose for me, it was a great exposure to politics in the war, to civil breakdown, to trust, to communities who felt let down and betrayed, and all the things which have become sadly so important to all of us in recent years were there in the microcosm in Northern Ireland. I developed a deep affection for the people of Northern Ireland and a great sympathy for them. I suppose I developed a distrust for people who had ideologies which suited them but might not suit other people. And I developed a profound distrust of ideological solutions to problems, particularly when they had a heavy religious overtone, because I could see where that had caused so many problems in Northern Ireland. Years later, Ben, I came back to Northern Ireland after I retired, because I was asked by the government to do an annual review of the security powers of the police. It's called the Justice and Security Act in Northern Ireland. So for 6 years, until fairly recently, I was there quite a lot, going around communities, talking to the police, talking to many former terrorists, many of whom had done many years in prison. And I felt it was quite important to try to build on the Good Friday Agreement and the understandings we had. And to me, it was absolutely amazing that some of these ex-terrorists were now prepared to sit and join in government. And I felt very positive about that. I have to say that now, with some of the recent developments in Northern Ireland, I feel more apprehensive, particularly about the effect of Brexit on the Protestant community and the way it's making them feel insecure again. And we know that that is never going to be a good thing. It opens the way to extremists and it hampers economic and social development. And I am apprehensive that all the good work done since the Good Friday Agreement might be put at peril. It may not. Wiser counsels may prevail. But I think there are some unfortunate developments there. So I'm watching that very carefully, as are many people.
I'd like to take you back to the 70s, being, you know, a young 20-something, meeting all of these people in Northern Ireland, being surrounded by such devastation, as you said, that a huge number of people were losing their lives at that time. You were drawn to the civil service because you enjoyed administration and organisation. Did you ever feel worried, unsafe? Did you feel as if actually, what have I got myself into here? I applied for a civil service job and suddenly I'm in Northern Ireland where I'm witnessing devastation all around me. Did you reconsider at that point?
No, I never felt like that at all, Ben. And I suppose there are three things that come out of that. The first is that I may have felt I was going to join something in relation to government and administration, but I was there pitched into the middle of a highly volatile political situation, and I had to develop political instincts and political antennae to get along with these people. It wasn't really a question of running something. Physically, we never felt in any danger because we were very, very well looked after. And I contrasted the fact that we were very well looked after with the fact that many people were not and were living in appalling circumstances. I remember one very bad day in Belfast when there were 20 bombs, many people dead and injured in the course of the day. And I was in the private office in Stormont Castle. And I kept the phone line open to the Home Office in London all day long. And actually, as the bombs went off in Belfast, they could hear them down the other end of the telephone line in London. It was as close as that. And when you've lived through that, I suppose you have some understanding of what it's like for ordinary poor people to be in the middle of that. For me, I could walk away. I eventually left there. But for those people, there was no escape, and their whole lives were dominated by the drama of the violence going on round about them. And how they survived and how they managed to do so with such resilience and courage is a source of admiration for me even now.
As a civil servant, something that I've always wanted to ask somebody who's done some of the roles that you've done, someone who's very high up in the government, but working as a civil servant, not an elected politician, how difficult is it to do your job in such a volatile political situation? And do you have to separate out your own views from the work that has to be done there? Is it difficult to reconcile how you feel with what you're doing and what's going on around you?
I never had any difficulty like that. And I guess it probably is more difficult for people now because it has become more complex. Certainly, you have to say, this is my professional job. I'm here to do this. I will leave my own personal feelings out of this. And you have to do that for your own peace of mind, Ben. If you can't do that, you're going to face with enormous emotional, personal challenges. And probably if that happens, the best thing is to resign. And many people have resigned because of that. I never had any difficulty in getting my view across. I was fortunate enough to work with people on the whole who listened to what I had to say. I suppose they listened to me because I'd been doing it for a long time. I had some experience and I had credibility because I was doing it. Nowadays, when people come in and out to senior jobs far too frequently, they don't build up the background, the knowledge, the corporate knowledge. They don't have the resilience. They don't know where the bodies are buried, literally in some cases. And I think you have, therefore, you're more exposed and less able to stand up to people who have their own agendas, and that's not particularly helpful. Of course, there always has been an interface between politics and administration. That's been the case all the way through, and many people flourish in that and some don't. In more recent times, there has been a system of special political advisors, the SPADs. And I never found that particularly difficult. I always made it my job to get alongside the SPADs, to work with them, probably find them one or two useful things to do, and then they wouldn't be such a nuisance to other people. And of course, I understand and realize that if civil servants can't give political advice, then politicians need to get it from somewhere. And I have no difficulty with the political advisor role. It becomes a problem if the political advisors take over the whole show. For example, if they block submissions going forward from civil servants to ministers, or if they so control the diary that civil servants don't get any access. And we've seen in recent times how that can get quite out of hand and it's corrosive. And when it goes wrong, it explodes in a spectacular form. And that can be unfortunate. So the best of the system combines a long-term bureaucracy, which has the knowledge and the understanding and knows how to make things work, with the kind of political flair which is needed nowadays to survive in a 24/7 world, particularly a 24/7 media world, which is, I think, where the advisors can play a particular role. But you get something like the pandemic, which is going to challenge everything. And at the best of it, the pandemic has been done very well. There are bits of the pandemic which I think have not been done quite so well. We all know that. I think when it comes to that kind of contingency planning, which I've worked on in the past in the Cabinet Office, we have to try and get the best of the corporate memory, plus all the fluency of the current issues and the current ideas, and try to blend that. And the most successful leaders are those who can blend the corporate memory and the flair of the current sparky people in the private office and make the best solutions. And when that gets out of balance, then I think we have problems. When it goes well, our system works as well as any in any other countries. For example, in France, the cabinet system works like that in a sort of much more political way. When I was working with the Americans, the levels of bureaucracy in the American system were political appointees for two levels below me. So I was dealing with political appointees in the American bureaucracy, and they used to admire the way that we had got a track record of having done things for so long. I used to admire the way they moved in and out of academic life, industry, in a way which we didn't. So there are pluses and minuses of all these systems. But for our system, if we can hold to the best of it and make it work, it will do what we want it to do. But we have to be nimble and quick thinking and original and prepared for new things to happen. And nobody could have thought the way the pandemic has turned out that we'd have to face the things we had of them. We could predict some of it, but not all of it.
Robert, I've got so many questions off the back of what you've just said. And if you don't mind, rather than going through a kind of chronology of your career, I'd love to just pick up on certain themes and run with those, if that's okay with you.
Of course.
The first one being, on the being a civil servant, in terms of the career and the life of a civil servant, we've all had good bosses, we've all had bad bosses. I suppose that there are good leaders and bad leaders, it doesn't matter what field you're in. How much more difficult is it for you as a civil servant if you've got an administration? I mean, how many administrations have you worked with, Robert? Or is that a difficult... Do you know the number, or is it too many to think?
I've worked for 14 Home Secretaries.
Okay.
14.
And of course, I'm, you know, without prying too much, I imagine that some of those were easier to work with than others?
Of course. Some were very easy to work with. Some were very difficult to work with. Some were very good at what they were doing. Some were incompetent with what they were doing. You had to take everything that came with you. In terms of being the Home Secretary, what really matters is to have the confidence of the House of Commons as much as anything else. And a Home Secretary who is not particularly good at the job, but is still trusted by the House of Commons, we can work with that. We can make that work. Once a Home Secretary has lost the trust of the House of Commons for whatever reason, either over a bad case or a bad policy, it is very difficult to retrieve that position. And however hard the civil servants try, you're always pushing the stone uphill at that point. So in an exposed role like that, values and trust, these inchoate considerations, which you can really just are difficult to explain, they become very important. And I certainly had the great value of working with some excellent Home Secretaries from both parties. I never had any problem working for either party. That was never an issue for me. What matters was that they should understand the issues, they should have all the information, and they should try and make some good decisions. And once they made good decisions, it was our job to stick to them. And of course, the front line was the Home Secretary getting up in the House of Commons, and you used to sit in the official's box next to the Speaker's chair, and you could guess the atmosphere and the mood. Is he or she going to carry the House on this issue or not? And when it came to the vote, you usually knew what the vote would be in advance because you'd sense the occasion. And if things went wrong, you had to pick it up and take it away and do it again. But there is something quite indefinable about the atmosphere in the House of Commons if you're sitting there just behind the minister picking it all up. And that's really what you have to think about that. And that drives you. Where do we go from here? How can we take this problem forward? That's not going to work. What else can we do? Who is unconvinced by what we're doing? And have we the means to convince them at all? Or do we need to think differently? And those issues should always be in your mind when you're a senior civil servant advising a minister in what is inevitably going to be a difficult situation.
If someone's listening to this then, Robert, who agrees that they like administration, they like organisation, they like structure, would you say that the civil service is the right career path for them? Because it sounds like you can make many plans that then suddenly all unravel because a vote doesn't go the right way? Or are you constantly reevaluating as a civil servant working for someone like the Home Office? Are you constantly changing plans? Can you make plans, or is it always evolving and constantly changing?
It's constantly changing. You think of the Clausewitz doctrine that no battle plan survives first contact with the enemy. That, of course, is true of many situations, not just the military one. And I think in the civil service, you have to think, you're thinking what ifs all the time. If I tell you that the Home Office has a very volatile brief, four times in my life, Ben, I went home at the end of the day from a different job from the one I'd come into in the morning. That's how fast events can move. And you have to be prepared for that. And in the Home Office in particular, you're at the mercy of some very sad and difficult events. You know, I think in a career in the Home Office, you learn quite a lot about the depths of human depravity, I'm afraid, sadly, one way or another. So you have to be prepared to reevaluate and think quickly and give people different options. If, for example, you're dealing with riots, as we've done many times in this country, whether caused by community tensions or caused by economic tensions, the standard solutions don't always work in those situations, and you have to be prepared to think quite originally and to get alongside people you might not find very easy to talk to if you want to make some progress. But I think that is part of the art of doing all this, to be prepared for things to change quickly and to be prepared to change with them quickly.
Just to finish on the kind of life of a civil servant and the lifestyle of a civil servant, I think today we are very conscious in every industry about work-life balance, about promoting positive mental health at work, in the workplace. Of course, very aware that stress can be as debilitating as a physical illness. With a job like working within the Home Office, are you ever able to switch off? Because surely you get home and you open up the newspaper and it's there. It's constant. You are dealing, as you said, with life and what's happening around us in the world constantly. Were you ever able to switch off, or is it something that dominates almost every thought?
I think, sadly, truthfully, you're never able really to switch off. You can do a bit at the weekends or on your holidays and so on, but you never really switch off. And I mean, I think I've discussed with my wife that we've been married to the Home Office for all those years, and we're still married to the Home Office in many ways. It is very difficult to get rid of it and to have it all going through your mind, partly thinking, how can we do this better? And partly reflecting on some of the extraordinary things that you may have had to deal with. Work-life balance, I think people are more aware of it now than when I was working, and people take more sense about it and more care of it. But the pressures are just as intense as they were. Remember, Ben, I didn't have an email to deal with for most of my working life. I did at the end. And the sort of work I was doing meant you couldn't take emails home. You couldn't do that. You couldn't read them on the train, and you couldn't do it at home. So I at least had that capacity. Many people now are pursued by their emails relentlessly, evenings and weekends, quite often in more junior roles than I had. And I think that is bad. It's insidious. It's bad for people's health. It has bound to have an impact and a rebound on their family life and their children and so on. You may say it's the inevitable result of the world in which we live, with multiple media, everybody getting it 24/7. But I think myself, there's a cost for that, for all of us, not just for people doing high profile jobs, but for people doing jobs much further down the food chain as well. I think it's unhealthy for them to have to be required to deal with so much stress and so many issues when they should be allowed some time to recreate themselves and restore themselves.
Can you therefore just have a job when it comes to being a civil servant? Or is there a sense of duty that drives you within that career?
Well, I think there's a sense of duty, a sense of wanting to make sure that there's a public good, a wider good. You're never going to get very rich working in the civil service. If you want to make money, don't do that. I think there's a sense of doing something interesting. I had a good friend at Cambridge who went on to work for a merchant bank. He made so much money, he retired at the age of 45 and bought an estate in Scotland. And we used to have lunch from time to time. And he used to say, you know, for all the money I've made, I haven't done anything as remotely interesting as you have. And that was quite a nice thing to realize and to recognize.
Hi, I'm Sana.
And I'm Betty, and we've been fundraising in support of the Assisted Places Scheme across each school. What's that, you ask?
The Assisted Places Scheme aims to provide access to excellence for all. So if you want to make a change,
start small and support the campaign. Thank you.
You mentioned that you were dealing with some extraordinary events that happened in the world. And I'd like to link this in with the pandemic, because I think there's some things that we've all become suddenly conscious of that we weren't necessarily really very aware of before in terms of the kind of working of government. And I think we all now know what a COBRA meeting is, for example. We often hear that on the news that, you know, depending on what happens next in terms of the government's response to coronavirus depends on a COBRA meeting. You chaired two COBRA meetings. Am I right in thinking that during the time that you were the Director of Counter-Terrorism and Intelligence, and it was around the 9/11 attack and also the London bombings of 2005. Have I got my facts right, first of all, Robert?
Yes, you're absolutely right, Ben, you have. I mean, I chaired COBRA meetings many times for over 5 years, because COBRA meets in many circumstances to deal with many different crises. And I would chair the official levels meetings. Sometimes meetings are chaired, but most of the time, most meetings are chaired by ministers. Sometimes you have an official level meeting to prepare for a ministerial level meeting. So I got very familiar with the COBRA system and I learned how to make it work. It has the great advantage of having people there from all over government. They know each other very well. They know each other's interests and agendas and red lines. They come together to work at a crisis. They train regularly over the weekends and things like that. So it is a very good way of getting on top of a problem and mobilizing the right people. It's not rank conscious. If this guy knows about this thing, get him in down here quickly, please, is the motto. Of course, you have to respect rank, particularly politicians who are very rank conscious. You have to make sure you have all the interests represented. For example, doing a lot of the counterterrorism work, there was a huge role for science. And we always had a role for the government chief scientific advisor. Now, of course, science has been the dominant factor in the pandemic. But how do you incorporate scientific thinking into political decision taking is a really difficult issue. And we've seen all that through the pandemic. I think it's been good to have the scientists so visible, and nothing is more important than this than consistency, having the same people that the public can get to know. They can follow the narrative and they can see these guys week after week, and they can calibrate what they're saying. In something like a pandemic, it moves beyond the sort of world of COBRA with the professionals and the specialists, and it becomes anybody you want to choose to talk to. So every morning, every day, you'll find a different scientific expert. They're all eminent people. They know their subject inside out, but they'll have slightly different nuances and takes on something. These are all reported every day by the newspapers, as if you were sort of reading the runes of the chicken's entrails as to what it's going to tell you about what's going to happen next. And this, I think, can be disturbing. And part of the problem of dealing with a pandemic has been how to deal with the wealth of knowledge, perfectly good knowledge from excellent people who know their fields very well. But they're saying slightly different things because they're coming at it from a slightly different point. And I think that politicians can find that confusing, which is why we've had so much mixed messaging, if I can use that phrase. And I think the public can find themselves completely bewildered. And that's not good, because you need to keep the public's trust and confidence if you want them to go on doing things which they don't particularly want to do, like stay at home. So all of this has been a challenge for us. I think probably we're getting marginally better at handling it, but I think it has been a real difficulty. And so these crises have moved out from beyond the COBRA world, where we could handle what was going on pretty well among ourselves with all the international contexts and so on, into open season in media terms and scientific terms, which makes it much more complex. And I think the public are the ones who suffer if the narrative becomes cloudy, diffused, or confusing.
So a Cobra meeting, then. I suppose this is the Netflix watcher in me that wants to know this, and I'm sorry if this takes us off on a slight tangent, but I'd love to know how the process of a Cobra meeting. So you're at home, and suddenly something happens. Where are they held? Who tends to be there? How long do they go on for? Because there's such the decisions that are made in these meetings by so few people affect millions and millions of lives. What's it like being in the room?
Well, we have to be careful what we're going to say here, Ben, because the public, the government on the whole, doesn't like to talk much about what happens in Cobra, and the processes there are necessarily kept within a fairly small community. So I fear we cannot go into the great deal of the detail of what you'd like to talk about in many ways. But of course, it's a small office, a building in the middle of Whitehall. It has a membership, which is depending upon the nature of the crisis, who's going to be there. There's usually a senior minister, the lead department in charge, could be the Home Secretary or the Foreign Secretary. The Prime Minister quite often does that. But I think the important things about it are you have all the people there who have an interest, all the main departments of the state. You have people like the military, the intelligence services, the police there. You have anybody who has a particular interest in the issue, and you're there to take decisions. It is not a talking shop. Cobra is there to take decisions, which then need to be followed through and communicated to the public. So you should think of it as a very small decision-taking instrument at the heart of government. That's the concept of it. I fear we can't go into too much of the detail. This is not Sir Humphrey speaking. This is really what we're bound by.
Do you feel the weight of the decisions that are made? Or is it a practical process that where we start with a problem and we work through to come up with our solutions and that is the right thing to implement? Or do you, as a human being, feel the weight of that decision? Is there any kind of nervousness around these Cobra meetings for you as an individual?
Not a nervousness, because you're there as a professional. But you are certainly well aware of all the implications of what's going on round about you. And if you're dealing with an operational crisis, for example, a hijacking overseas of a ship, for example, or an aeroplane, or you're dealing with an operational crisis such as an explosion, a terrorist incident, where you're getting conflicting news coming in all the time, you're aware of casualties, you're aware of huge emotions being opened across a whole range of communities, and it's a very dynamic and fluid situation. So you're aware of all of that, and the weight of all of that is absolutely inescapable. This is where you have to rely upon your training, your skills, your awareness, your contacts, what you don't know as much as what you do know, and be prepared to open up to that kind of dialogue, but you're there essentially to help ministers take difficult decisions about what to do. And you should never lose sight of that.
It almost sounds like you have to have quite a military mindset when you're working for the Home Office. Would you agree in terms of the discipline and rely on your training?
Well, I think military isn't quite the right word. You have to have a disciplined mindset. But then, Ben, you have to be disciplined in most walks of life, don't you? You certainly do in the medical world. I'm sure you do in your world, in the scientific world. Disciplines come in many forms, but certainly you have to be focused, if you're a civil servant, on what is the best outcome here? What do we need to do? How do we make it happen? What might get in the way? What are the challenges going to be? And how do we get it right? And I think that kind of inherent discipline It's not a military discipline. It comes from having a trained mind. In my case, I learned to think at King Edward's School, and I learned to think at Cambridge, and those things have been with me all my life. And I think that's the way you can get through these things. People who haven't had that background may sometimes be able to innovate more than we can, or to think more alternatively about issues, and that absolutely is a very valuable way of doing it. But sometimes, somehow, you have to bring all that together into a decision-taking mode, which means you're focusing all these various influences on taking the right decision to move a problem forward to the next stage or over the longer term.
Robert, I'd like to talk to you now about your role as the Director of Immigration Policy. I feel as if that is a very different role that requires very different skills to that, for example, of your counterterrorism role, which I imagine is quite responsive in many ways.
Yes, I think the immigration role was certainly the most intellectually challenging job I ever had. And to answer the fundamental question, why do people want to migrate? Why does someone want to go and live in another country? Is something you always have to have in your mind. How can you make that happen in a good way? And how can you look after the interests of other people who might be affected in other countries? And that is always going to be a major issue. In our world, we have a complicated immigration policy. I got involved with all sorts of wonderful, wonderfully difficult issues. While I was there, we had the transition in Hong Kong from being a British colony to returning to mainland China. And I had to go to Hong Kong many times to try to find some solution to the issue about what would happen if all the people who were living in Hong Kong and had a right to come to Britain wanted to come to Britain. What would that do for Hong Kong, for Britain, for many other people? And we managed to find a solution which meant people felt reasonably reassured to stay in Hong Kong and not to evacuate. I worked with Michael Howard when he was Home Secretary, and Chris Patten, who was a brilliant governor of Hong Kong, and I worked with him very closely. Nowadays, of course, we've seen more recently some of the problems with Hong Kong, the breakdown of trust in whether the political institutions will deliver what was agreed in 1997, and whether people might want to come here from Hong Kong and relocate here. And all that is probably going to be with us for some time now. And that's a sadness for me and for those of us who thought we were trying to work out some kind of viable political solution which would give people a reasonable peace of mind in Hong Kong. And that, I think, is sadly not going to be as straightforward as it was. I had many occasions to deal with the Chinese government. You may remember, Ben, that there was an instance where a lorry was found at Dover with 58 dead Chinese people on board, each of whom had paid many thousands of pounds to a snakehead in Fujian province to come to the UK. And this was a major crisis, 58 dead people asphyxiated in the back of a truck. So I went to Beijing several times, leading a delegation to try and talk to the Chinese government about how we could stop this thing happening, what could be done to control the activities of these ruthless gangs in China who are putting people into trucks, trying to bring them to the UK and then abandoning them so they died. It was difficult to get through to the Chinese government at times the enormity of what we were dealing with. And they are a very skilled organization. I developed a deep respect for Chinese bureaucracy, which goes back many thousands of years, of course. But you had to learn how to negotiate skillfully and try to find possible solutions which would mean you could do something to stop this kind of tragedy ever happening again. So that was an important role. I also had quite a lot to do with the European Union on migration policy within Europe, visas and rules for people to come and live here. I went to Brussels over 100 times in my time, and I learned how to negotiate in Brussels, the things which you could manage to achieve and the things which you couldn't achieve in a group of 15 countries, or as it then became 25. And I learned all of that as well. I had, of course, the issues of family reunion, people coming from India, Pakistan, and other Asian countries to join their families in the UK. And these are things you have to deal with sensitivity, and you have to learn and develop an understanding and respect for different cultures from your own as to how these issues are perceived. And that was certainly something which I valued and I found I was, could contribute to, but I came at it from a limited knowledge, and I had to learn and understand what sort of things mattered to the Asian community, for example, and how we could respect their family values and traditions. So all of that made it a very intellectually challenging role, but one which I enjoyed very much. I did that for 7 years.
Immigration is usually a very political issue, and it's a very emotive issue. It feels like, in terms of the kind of general public, the complicated nature of immigration and immigration policy isn't thoroughly understood, and there can be quite strong views either way. In almost a yes, I agree that with the free movement of people, or no, I don't. In terms of the, would you agree that that is a, that's how the public are divided, or do you think that they do understand the many complications and difficulties that come with trying to set a policy on immigration?
Well, I think some of it is understood, and some of it is not so very well understood for all the reasons that you give, particularly when it comes to free movement and allowing people the chance to go and move to another country. It is very complicated and it can become very emotive, and people can take up positions on either side of this. We've seen how this can go badly wrong. But if you get it right, you are able to facilitate people who want to go and live in another country. You're able to facilitate your own country's economic or social needs in a way which doesn't denude other countries of their skilled workforce. That's another part of it. For example, take the healthcare sector, or the social care sector in this country. We rely upon people from countries such as the Philippines who come and look after our old people. We don't pay them very much, and we have a duty to treat them with respect, and also not to take away from the Philippines those people who may be able to make a contribution in their own country. We should think of it in terms of not just our needs, but other countries' needs as well. And I think unless you can get that kind of debate into it, you're going to find some sort of problems. One of the things which saddened me about the Brexit debate was the way we began to treat people from the European Union as if they were hostile elements. And I found that very sad. And I think we've got a lot of work to do to undo the damage that has caused to the way we think about people from other countries. And to sort of try and pull up the drawbridge and wave the Union flag is very sad. The modern world isn't like that. And we'll be the ones who suffer from that kind of mentality, I fear.
I'd like to talk to you about the current situation with immigration, because I'm 32, Robert, and I suppose it hasn't, from my perspective, and I'm you know, obviously from a layman's perspective here, it feels like from the kind of Tony Blair's government through to David Cameron's government, not much changed when it came to immigration policy. It feels like the changes that have been made under Johnson's government since Brexit are quite major. How different is this current government's approach to immigration to former governments and some of the Home Office ministers that you've worked for?
Well, it's not that different in terms of the way people take positions or take attitudes. There's nothing much that's significantly different between this government and other governments in the past. And politicians of all shades have got varying personal views about this, some more strident than others, in all parties. It isn't a particular issue for this government. What is different, of course, is that we are no longer in the European Union. And so the whole of our rules have to be revised to take account of that. The way we treat European Union nationals is completely different legally and has to be. And the way we can treat other countries hasn't changed. We've always had our own policies for countries from outside the European Union, whether it's India or Australia or whatever. But what is different, of course, is that we have to do it now within a completely different legal framework. That's the consequence of the Brexit decisions, which I personally regret, but that's not something we can go over now. But the implication of that is that we have to think about different ways of dealing with the the requirements of our own community and society. What sectors do we want to encourage and flourish? We know how vulnerable we are in the National Health Service to any sort of movement of people, and how dependent we are upon other countries sending us their skilled workforce. So these are very sensitive issues. They're sensitive political issues. They're sensitive for our relations with other countries. They're sensitive for the effectiveness of the kind of systems we provide to look after our people here. So you can't separate out the question of immigration from the question of welfare and policy for people in our country. They are absolutely linked together. And you have to do this with great sensitivity. Problems come when people take a position very stridently, one or the other. And that's when the debate deteriorates and we lose sight of what we're trying to do.
Robert, I could talk to you for hours about your career. It's been so lovely to speak to you, and thank you for being so open. Of course, there's some things that we haven't been able to venture into. I always end this podcast, Robert, by asking people about not a certificate, qualification or mentor, but a characteristic that they feel has served them best throughout the duration of their career. You've mentioned a few times throughout our conversation that some of your values were developed at King Edward School. What would you say is the characteristic that has served you best from the moment that you got that letter to say civil service, Home Office?
I suppose the feeling that I had such a tremendous start in life at King Edward's. I learnt all the values of integrity, intellect, judgment, that have stayed with me all my life. I remember once I was after 9/11, I went to America many times. I helped them set up the Department of Homeland Security. And I remember once I was in the White House in one of the meetings in the West Wing in the White House talking to senior officials of the administration. And I thought to myself, here am I, an ordinary boy from Brum, in the middle of the West Wing of the White House, talking to some of the most senior people in the land in the most important building in the world. How has it come to this, I thought? What happened? How did we get here? And now we're here, what are we going to do about it? And the answer is, you think back to all of the skills you learned at King Edward School, the things it taught you, how to manage situations and people, and how to do so, retaining your own personal integrity. And I think that's the kind of thing I learned at school, which kept me going through many perilous situations all those years. I hope that doesn't sound too corny, but it's a way to which I can end this discussion with you.
And it's a great end. Robert, thank you ever so much for taking the time to talk to me today. As I said, this could go on for hours, but at some point we do have to end. So Robert Worley, thank you ever so much.
Thank you very much, Ben, and good wishes to you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on, so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. If you would like to feature on this podcast as a guest, then please email Adelaide Bailey at the Development Office. Her email address is aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. That's aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. She's also the person to email with any news that you think should be featuring in Old Ed's publications, either in print or online. Finally, if you think a podcast would enhance the communications of your business, organisation or charity, then I'd love to talk to you about producing it. My email address again is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me again.